So here suddenly you say, we have a thing that by doing something that humans can't do can learn something that's superhuman. And it's scale compute and it's scale data. And it was like, okay, we are now back in the game, because as opposed to programming, we are programming, but we're programming learning machines. It's learning, sitting on a couch, kind of responding numbly to stimulus, like for example, just, you know, drinking lots of sugary soda and watching mind-numbing stuff is all you're doing, we would think that would be a decrease in human agency, human capability, etc. What we want to be doing is we want to be learning how to be better versions of ourselves, how to be intelligent, wise, compassionate, how to be engaging with other human beings. My fundamental thesis about the line of sight from where we are in AI, and it isn't to say that this isn't everything and it's not guaranteed forever, but it's human amplification. Namely, we get superpowers. The reason I couldn't sign it is that it's not the same, because AI also has a positive column. And the best way that I can think of to prevent pandemic, man-made or natural, and to have that existential risk greatly mitigated is AI.
Touching on the other thing you mentioned, it's about this, okay, we are creating these agents, these companions, yes, like with GPT-4o, it's kind of movie hair is becoming a reality.
Yes.
And then on one hand, there is many good reasons why this is a good thing. On the other hand, there is this kind of this parasocial relationship that might be maybe not necessarily a positive thing. So in particular, to many, hair is a dystopia, not a utopia for sure. So you already mentioned a little bit how you make sure that Pi is not contributing to this. Yeah. But like, do you think that's the only worry that we should have over here? Is there something else? Hey, I'm Alexander, and welcome to Before AGI. We talk a lot about AI, but we actually don't talk that much about how to use it. Indeed, for all of the discussions of integrating AI into our work and personal lives, it is not clear how to actually go about doing that. It is just great to have today Reid Hoffman with us. Reid is someone who knows quite a bit about this topic. He has even co-written a book, Impromptu, with GPT-4. But Reid is not just an AI power user. He is someone who has been involved in the development of AI from the get-go. He is in particular a long-time investor into AI companies. He co-founded Inflection AI and also was a funding investor as well as a board member of OpenAI. I'm excited to talk to him today about his experiences and learn how he thinks about the impact AI will have on our world. Reid, it is a pleasure to have you.
Great to be here.
So first, I wanted to actually thank you for appearing in person. So I saw this interview with your twin AI, so now I didn't know what to expect. So unless there were some progress in robotics that I have not realized, then yeah, you are in person. We're very happy to have you here.
Well, to mimic Reid AI, you know, I think it's fine. And you know, we have...
Good one. So now yes. I have suspicions, but let's assume you are in person. So how did it come about? Like, how do you come up with this idea of interviewing your digital twin?
Roughly speaking, the broad thing is whatever problem you think there is with technology, technology can also be the solution. So that's the orientation you should be taking. And I do think that one of the problems we have this year, 2024, is with deepfakes, you know, kind of misinformation in elections and so forth. And if I could wave a wand and the entire world couldn't do deepfake video, deepfake audio, I would wave it off this year. Mm. Of course, that wand doesn't exist. It's a fake thought experiment. And so then the question is, how do we start navigating it? And you have to explore it. And if the only exploration of this is, oh, look, it's a fake video of Trump saying he's not a sexist or, you know, not a racist or anything like that. And it's, you know, it's a fake video of Trump saying that stuff. Then you go, well, okay, what is that? You know, et cetera. And so how do we begin to explore it? And then how do we start seeing what the positive sides of the universe are? And I think that part of the thing that I will be showing, the first one was really just to kind of, whoa, we're in a different world. It was a very simple thing. I actually even had friends of mine who couldn't watch it the whole way through because they were a little weirded out by it.
Wow.
Right? But that was, again, get exposure, start thinking, getting inoculated, what's bad, what's good, et cetera. And then over the next few months, we'll be revealing, I think, some of the lenses, the beams of light on how I can use this to make more human connection.
Okay, that's a very interesting take on that. So why do you think someone should or shouldn't have a digital twin like that?
So I think there's a number of things that you could have a digital twin on. It's probably not you shouldn't, but probably shouldn't in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So for example, we were very clear, this is not digital twin. When we use it in various, my Read AI, my digital twin in various ways, we identify that there is a digital twin. It doesn't have to be like, well, this sentence in this podcast, that was said by AI audio. It's like, no, we're using Read AI audio in this podcast, you know, possible master skills center, and it's here. It's like, okay, great. So you should be disclosive and forthcoming. You should have a principle about why it's good for your listener, not just good for you. There's something that's just good for me. It's like, oh, well, I don't have to, like, I have to put less energy in a podcast thing. That's something. But what are the things that lead it to be good for the listener? So depending on exactly when this airs, one of the things that we'll show is what we'll be doing in the next couple months is me speaking in other languages. We've already done it a little bit, Klingon, et cetera, just for joke. But I'm going to be delivering a speech in Perugia about artificial intelligence, Renaissance, and humanism. And we are going to release that speech through Read AI in Italian, obviously, but other languages as well. That's an example of extending human connection. And I, look, maybe if I spent 2 years studying a language and so forth, I could do that. That's never going to happen. And I think there's a variety of those things that when you begin to think about, oh, here's how I could use this digital twin, this avatar, this kind of digital representation of me in ways that are beneficial to other people, at least as well, right? Then that becomes a very good thing.
Yeah. So what is the most surprising thing that you learned about yourself from this interview? Because it's like holding a mirror to yourself. So what did you learn?
Well, one of the pieces of social study is that people they like looking at themselves in a mirror to get ready to go out. They don't like looking at videos of themselves.
Yes.
And that was definitely kind of one of the experiences. It was kind of weird. And as I ended the video, it was, look, I literally said, I thought I was going to hate this. I was doing it anyway because I thought it was important to see the future, but I was going to hate it. And instead I found it interesting. And part of it's because, you know, it's like sometimes you might think by speaking to yourself or like taking a walk and having an internal voice, that kind of dialogue was actually, in fact, kind of an interesting mirror for self-reflection and thinking. And that's another thing we're going to explore more of.
Yeah, so having this, your like brainstorming with yourself kind of has a new meaning.
Yes.
So actually, this gave me an idea, you know. I realized, okay, we are using AI, so let's go forward. So I'm not sure if you heard, but OpenAI has a new toy to play with. Yes. So this is GPT-4o. So
excellent.
How about that? Hey, ChatGPT, I'm here with Reid Hoffman, and I'm doing an interview with him about AI. But actually, I'm unprepared, so could you do the interview for me?
Hey there, sure, I can help with that. Let's dive right in. Friedrich, what inspired you to start working in the field of AI?
Well, your first error is it's not Friedrich, it's Reid, and to help you, it's Reid Hoffman. And I started as an undergraduate at Stanford because I was curious about how we think and speak, we human beings, and how we learn about ourselves, each other, and the world.
Apologies for that, Reid. That's a fascinating journey into AI. How do you see the role of AI evolving in our understanding of human thought and communication?
Okay, I actually did prepare the questions, so so yes. Thank you for that.
Yes,
but good. It's good, right? Well, yes. Except it didn't get your name right,
yes.
But
yes.
We will fix that.
Yes.
So
small bug.
No, but this might be the future, right?
Yes.
Where you kind of do it exactly this way. So I must say I'm a big fan of how innovative you engage with AI, and you kind of do it personally and also in your professional life and so on. So kind of, for instance, you did this like fireside chats with GPT 3.5 when it came up, you know, like you have this book written with GPT-4. So why are you doing this? Like what kind of, like why do you keep doing this kind of like coming up with all these innovative ways to engage with AI?
It's a couple reasons. The macro one is to, and when you can, don't just tell, show and tell. And my fundamental thesis about the line of sight from where we are in AI, and it isn't to say that this isn't everything and it's not guaranteed forever, but it's human amplification. Namely, we get superpowers, right? So just like the Industrial Revolution gave us physical superpowers, we could build bigger things, we could lift things, we could transport. Now we're getting mental superpowers, yeah. And that's really interesting. And I wanted to write that book, started with Impromptu. Well, actually, I guess I might have been the Fireside Chatbots earlier.
Yeah.
But I wanted to show it because I wanted people to stop going, because the general media discourse was, oh my God, AI is here. It's already damaged our democracy. It's coming for our jobs. It may be coming for our lives. There's even people who are building it who are like, oh my God, AI is so dangerous. Why is anyone doing this? And they're not seeing this, like, actually, in fact, the vast majority of people who are building this are building this for very good reasons that involve how do we elevate ourselves? How do we amplify ourselves as human beings? How do we get more capabilities? How do we become better at connecting with each other, better at understanding the world, ourselves, connecting in terms of relationships with each other? And that's all like line of sight to what we're doing. Improvements in work, improvements in life, improvements in medicine, et cetera. And so I wanted to start articulating that message against this massive cacophony of the risks and the negative. And as I was doing it, I was like, well, you can show it too. So let's show it. Let's have a podcast, mm-hmm. Which I think I did the first one with chatbot, GPT 3.5.
Yeah.
And then I was doing the book and I was like, well, shoot, I should do this with GPT-4. And I don't think there's going to be a lot of books in the future that are written in this kind of, wrap a dialogue with it. But I wanted to show the Chrome. I wanted to show the instance of it to get people some understanding. And one of the side little surprises of it was people said, look, one of the things I didn't expect to take away from your book, which was really helpful, was learning what prompts to bring. Like what is too often described as prompt engineering, I think it should be called prompt directing, but how do you get superpowers out of it? What do you do in order to get magic out of it? And that was, of course, obviously, because I had well over 1,000 pages of prompts and answers, and the book's 236 pages, and a bunch of that's my own writing too. So you could tell that a lot of it got edited away.
But how does exactly this process look like? Because you said you are kind of sending these prompts to the model, get something back, and so how did it actually work exactly? And the reason why I'm asking is that essentially, like, I am an academic, and one thing that the academics are supposed to be doing is writing books. Yes. And I promise myself that we'll never write a book, right? Just like, this is one thing, I'm just incapable of doing it. But now I'm intrigued, so I want to know what the process is.
So one of the things that when you author anything, including a book, what you're doing is saying, I believe with some strength and vigor, this is worth other people's times to engage with. Mm-hmm. Some people may be worth reading the whole book, some people may be worth skimming the book, et cetera, but I can recommend the book mm-hmm. as valuable to your attention. Mm-hmm. So one thing I think will be there for a long time still is, even if you're using some of the most advanced AI models and prompting it in various ways to generate it, like if you say, look, I'd like the whole book to be essentially outputs from generations from frontier models, fine, but you're still gonna have to look at it and go, is this worth it to say, my friend Alex, should he read this, right? And why? And would I be willing to engage in a multiple hour long conversation about what I've written here because I think it's important? And that's the reason why there were tons of prompts that didn't go anywhere. And for me, it was also a great experience on, like, if you just said, write something interesting about AI, it's okay. If you don't know anything about AI, that might be an okay prompt. You and I, we go, okay. Like, we literally would stop paying attention if someone told us that. But if you start saying, okay, what would the philosopher Wittgenstein say about modern generative AI models? And if he was critiquing an analytic philosopher's approach on this, what might Wittgenstein say? Then all of a sudden, you begin to get something that is worthy of dialogue.
Yes, so this kind of ideas, I was talking to Sal Khan, and like he uses it in context of education, just like having the discoverer, like the Newton, explain to you the laws of physics that he discovered, and so on. And kind of it makes both for more engaging thing, but also essentially like there is certain narrative that kind of comes with this. So we can say the same information in different perspective, and it will stick and land with you differently. So I think this is a very powerful thing that normally is very difficult to do, but with AI becomes much easier. So, again, you spend a lot of time with AI interacting with it. So, what were the biggest surprises in kind of what you discovered when in this process, that kind of what we were not expecting coming into it?
So, and I'd had the benefit of being on the OpenAI board, so I knew a lot of what was coming. So, my surprise coefficient was probably lower or different than the world at large. But I'd say a couple things. So one, and I think the model's gotten better for this, but it was terrible dialogue. I really wanted to have some dialogue in Impromptu. There's literally a couple hundred pages of prompts trying to do a dialogue. And it was so bad that it was like, I mean, it was not bad a la the English was grammatic and so forth. But it was boring and useless, right? And the kind of thing that is, again, our curator. So that's an example on the negative side. It's also because we are naturally going carefully into this new world. And I love Sal Khan's title of his new book, Brave New Words.
Yeah.
But we're going carefully into it. We do a lot of things for safety and alignment training, which is good because we want to minimize the chance that these models are used for harm, either self-harm or other harm or anything else. And so we try to do a lot, and that involves a lot of safety training. The problem is that also makes them less interesting, less easy to get edgy things. Like what would be a, you know, kind of a theory of the universe that would be something that would be very contrarian to, current contemporary thought that might be true. Say that, like that kind of prompting is much harder. So that would be another thing that I would want more of, didn't get. It was like, okay, that's an interesting thing. Now, on the positive side, one of the things that was kind of a surprise in the ways that these AI models are human-like, because they're trained, of course, on human language and human culture and human knowledge. And so even though their learning pattern, I think, is substantially more different than most of the people are like, oh, this is brain-inspired. It's like, look, the brain's a lot different, not just in wattage and everything else. But by the way, it is a learning algorithm, and it's out of learning human knowledge and patterns and culture, and language and so on. So it's like, okay, there's a bunch of stuff there. One of the most interesting and easy ways to get valuable things, it's a little bit like what I was saying with the, prompt a la Wittgenstein. But it's prompting to, say, take on a role, answer this question like a cultural anthropologist. Answer this question like an MIT professor. Answer this question like, and you can expand from that. But when you start doing that, all of a sudden, it gets much better. Because it's almost like it wants to be told, what role do you want this dialogue, this prompt, this answer to be? Because then all of a sudden, it starts getting much more interesting. And that was among the things that until I started playing with it, I didn't realize, and now that's like almost always, almost anything I do, I will do something that kind of prompts a role.
This is a really fascinating take, and quite different to how I got kind of hooked on this kind of models, because I actually have very mundane use for them. Yeah? So you want to have an intellectually stimulating partner. At first, I just wanted to something that helps with like mundane stuff. So for instance, my schedule got garbled when I was copy-pasting it, can you fix it? And what I really struck me the most is that like it kind of gets you. Yes, like you're just saying, oh, here's my schedule, I want it nice. And it just like figures out what nice means. And that was kind of my way into, into interactions, like daily interactions with these models. Still, like a lot of people use these models. I think more of them should use them. So why do you think the adoption is not like as maybe deep as yours or mine among people?
Well, people are slow. I mean, take, for example, search, right? So we've had, internet search for over 20 years now. And most people are still not even very good at using search. They think look up Reid Hoffman. What's the Wikipedia page? They don't go, okay, what's the thing that I would be most curious about Reid Hoffman? Like, okay, who are the strongest experts who agree with what Reid Hoffman says about entrepreneurship, and what do they say? And who are the strongest experts who disagree with what Reid Hoffman says about entrepreneurship, and what do they say? Like, there's patterns that you can use search for that the vast majority of people don't use it. And that's, search has been around. Like, everybody who has a smartphone has used search, has been around, and they just don't, they don't know what to bring to it. And that was part of the reason I wanted to start doing the book impromptu, started doing the podcast, because, like, look, you can get magic out of it, and you don't even have to bring magic to get it out. You just have to do some things and try some things. And that's the reason why it's going to take longer, because people don't just, when they sit in front of a empty text box, like they sit in front of a search text box, they don't naturally go, what do I do? I'll give you an example of something that I teach people to use LinkedIn for. And like, the vast majority of people don't do this. So say, for example, like I'm going to, you know, at the end of this month, beginning of next month, I'm going to a BrainMind conference in New York. I'm like, okay, who else should I see when I'm in New York? I go to LinkedIn, I go, who are my contacts in New York by First Degree? And I just look through it. And of course, there's, for every one, they go, oh yeah, I should look up, you know, any number of people. I probably shouldn't be, you know, without permission saying people's names here, but I should look up so-and-so, and I wouldn't have remembered because my brain doesn't index like a computer, but having looked through my connections on LinkedIn, this is another example of use of search. So what we have is we have this amazing new cognitive amplifier. It's a cognitive amplifier that's a greater cognitive amplifier than a car is to our mobility amplifier. Start using it. Start playing with it. Clean up your calendar. Think about it, like, so, well, but I don't want to have it answer my emails for me because I want to keep that personal touch. It's like, well, you can always say, give me a draft of the email and now I'll change it. And then it'll still be you, because it'll be like, the okay, is it channeling me the right way? And so that's the reason, not only has it been slow, but it will continue to be.
Okay. In defense of search, though, or rather inability to use it, like, I used to be good at search. Now I just don't know how to use it the right way. So that's maybe I got lazy because of all this kind of AI interactions there.
Well, but talk about AI. So, for example, a very good use of these frontier models is to get a precise search query when I'm looking for X, what should I put into Google or Bing?
Okay, that's a okay. I got something from this conversation today. That's a new use.
It works.
That I will use. It works. Okay, you were there before me then. Yes. So okay, let's back up a bit. So you clearly were fascinated with AI for a while. Why? Like, how did you know it would be big?
So well, I didn't. I mean, I knew more recently it'd be big. I'll start with why I was fascinated, and then I will go into my realization of the current. So in realizing what was going to, and why I was interested is, how do we understand ourselves? How do we understand each other, the world? How do we come to a decision of truth? How do we come to a decision of values? It's through this kind of reasoning and discourse. And then I wanted to be as precise about it as possible, which is one of the reasons I did AI as an undergraduate and philosophy as a graduate student, because I was trying to figure that out, right? Then in the modern trend, I first got reconnected through DeepMind with the self-playing algorithms, because the thing that I realized from the self-playing algorithm was that the intensity of the mistake that had been made on most AI patterns before was that they were, we're going to program the AI. We're going to encode knowledge in it. And it just not, it's just, it. It's beyond us, right? It's just not there. So here suddenly you say, we have a thing that by doing something that humans can't do can learn something that's superhuman, and it's scale compute and it's scale data. And it was like, okay, we are now back in the game, because as opposed to programming, we are programming, but we're programming learning machines. It's learning, and you have to set up the learning the right way. And then the whole question is, and people tend to say, well, everything is going to be LLMs now. I'm like, look, LLMs are amazing. And we still have much more magic to discover from LLMs. But by the way, if it's only LLMs that is our only learning paradigm, that would be a substantial surprise. It'd be like you discovered oil on your very first look for energy. It's kind of like, okay, right? It's like, no, I think it's going to be more in terms of the scale compute. And so I started getting involved in it because I said, okay, this scale compute and this change from programming to learning is going to revolutionize everything. Now, I didn't know the time frame then. That was when I started going, okay, you know, helping, you know, Sam and Elon set up OpenAI, getting to know the DeepMind people very well, getting to know Yann LeCun well, you know, working my way through the different kind of scale compute places. And then it was when I saw the difference between, at OpenAI, GPT-2 and GPT-3. And I went, I see a trajectory, yeah. And I believe that trajectory to 4, and maybe even further. I mean, it's not saying 4 only, it's saying at least till 4. Okay, the revolution has started.
But that's fascinating. So when you were kind of in this relatively early days of OpenAI, DeepMind, Yann LeCun, well, there are clearly companies / people who think about AI in a very different way. So how could you kind of describe these differences between them? Like kind of how do you view their different perspectives on this field?
Well, one of the things that I thought, the question is, what's the set of tool set that gets us the most interesting cognitive capabilities? And there's one thesis, which I think OpenAI has been the strongest proponent of, which is what you need is a deep learning network with scale and with a set of tools to unlock the deep learning network. So it's like attention, scale, and data. And then you can make this work. Now, it's not just as simple as pressing a button. There's a whole bunch of work that goes into it, but that's enough to create really amazing magic, possibly getting to this term that is bandied about a lot, AGI. I tend to, when I'm joking, say AGI is the AI we haven't invented yet.
Let's hope.
Look, there's one sense in which we have AGI already. If you said, for example, there's a wide range of very important human cognitive tasks that AI can do successfully. We got there with GPT-4. Another set of people said Turing test. Well, we got there, right? So those things are doable, but it's like, yeah. Okay, well, that's not what we meant by AGI. All right, fine. That's the not yet. Now, obviously, we're working on reasoning and a bunch of other things, and there's a stack of things come. So there's one cluster around just intensifier on that. Then there's other people who say there's different things that need to be part of the equation. Some of it is that it needs to be that an LLM is only a component to a modular architecture. Some of it's that we need to have embedded learning within the world, and so you need perception and so forth. Some of it is you need to have a connection to symbolic architecture in various ways, and on and on. For this stuff. And that's the reason why, you know, as is classic for very smart researchers who each think they have a unique approach to creating or seeing what is artificial intelligence or artificial general intelligence, you can more or less find at least 10 to 15 different perspectives that think everyone else is foolish and they have the one true path to this.
Yeah, of course, and my path is the right one.
Yes.
So that's how it works. Okay, so obviously, I am interested in OpenAI and being there, and you have been at the beginning of the journey. So what are your fondest memories from that time and maybe some of the most interesting anecdotes?
Well, I suspect we'll go into this in some depth. So I'll just start with some of the kind of easiest ones. Two small notes. So one, because Sam, Elon, and I had a number of different meals where we were talking about this. And one was that I think it was Sam said to Elon, everyone that I know who's smart thinks we're living in a simulation. And I said, well, question for the two of you, am I smart? And they said, oh, yes, you're smart. I was like, okay, then your statement's incorrect. Because right. Look, that's a complicated thing there. But I tend to think that the thinking about whether or not we're living in a simulation is usually philosophically unwise in some of its reasoning. It isn't to say that it couldn't be discovered, but it's not as simple as, you know, a Nick Bostrom thought experiment about the number of different civilizations that create simulated civilizations and the probability that you're in a civilization, or looking at the Fermi paradox going, why haven't we discovered the intelligent signals and other things? Because, by the way, sometimes the explanation of a mystery is just, we don't know yet.
Yes.
Right? And that we don't know yet is an important thing to keep in mind. That was one. Two is, we were circling around, okay, we're going to do this. And at the time, one of the things that Elon was saying a lot was the word robocalypse. And I thought this was a classic area where critics are trying to be truth tellers and trying to be helpful, but with a good intent, they're doing something that's enormously destructive because it's focusing people on the negatives. It's like, you know, oh, is the natural work of AI lead to the Terminator, because we've seen the movies and we're storytelling creatures. And so I was like, look, my price for joining on this journey and for contributing and helping set it up and everything else is you have to stop using the word robocalypse.
Well, I think you succeeded because that's the first time I hear it. So yes. So that's definitely one of the things to add to your CV.
Yes.
We will talk a little bit about AI safety, but just a little bit later. And the reason is that I actually wanted to exactly explore with you this like positive side of AI. So yes, so you were involved in setting up OpenAI. At some point, I think you backstopped the salaries for some of the researchers.
When Elon left because he felt that OpenAI should convert to a company that he completely owned and controlled, and the researchers wanted to stay on the 501c3 mission for humanity, he said, okay, I'm out. Mm-hmm. And so Sam called me, said, what should we do? I said, look, I'll guarantee the salaries. He said, great. Can you come sit down with Greg and Ilya? Because, you know, they are critical for this, and you know, them understanding and knowing you better and so forth would be good. So I came in, I think it was the next day or two, and you know, spent a couple hours with them in a room, being interviewed. Actually, it was interesting being essentially interviewed for, you know, like what my positions on AI were and how I think about that. It wasn't just, okay, that's great, you're going to give money, that's awesome. We need to understand why,
exactly,
and are you a good contributor here and all that, which I loved. I thought that was like great. I have higher confidence that I'm doing the right thing here, and so. And then joined the board, and actually is a funny part of that, which obviously is a little bit of a presage to something that happened last year. Sam and I were doing a fireside chat with the whole company, and Sam, with no warning to me, asked me, what will you do if I'm doing a bad job? Right. And this is the first time I've been on a lot of boards. I've invested in a number of companies. I think I've frankly lost track of the number of boards I've been on, commercial and nonprofit. I have never been asked this question by a CEO in front of a company before or since.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't really know what questions he's asking me. So I'm like, well, I would work with you. I'd try to make it better. He's like, no, no. So I continued to just do a bad job. Right? And I'm like, well, then I'd fire you. And he's like, great. And then we moved on. I'm like, okay. Right. And look, to Sam's credit, which he... the public commentary doesn't give him enough, is Sam, unlike many people, and it's part of the reason he didn't want to go to a commercial company that, you know, was 100% owned and controlled by Elon, he is trying to make sure control is diversified. Mm-hmm. And part of the misfire last November was also from Sam's good intentions of, it is not my solo control. I am diversifying control. And that was when I learned that about Sam, because it was like he wanted to demonstrate it to the employees. So he ambushed me with a question, which, you know, it would have been helpful to tell me in advance.
Yeah.
But I think he wanted to be able to tell the employees. I didn't tell Reed I was going to ask him that question. That was the genuine answer from that. And that was true because he hadn't asked me. So that was another thing, you know, from the very early days. Now, part of the thing that I love about the OpenAI culture and the folks that are doing is they are very committed to the AI for humanity, to the last person in the company. It's not just the safety group, like everybody there. I have literally not talked to anybody who that isn't a front and center, you know, kind of consideration, why they're working here, what they're doing. Second is that they're very disciplined about, let's try that. And if that ends up not being the right path, we abandon it, we move on. Like part of what's led to OpenAI leading the large language model revolution is there was a lot of other projects. There was the simulated robotic hand and the Rubik's Cube. There was, you know, Dota and the games. And there was a whole bunch of stuff because they were like, well, which of these elements of scale are going to be really important? And they would try it and they go, is that going to get us further along in helping implement the entity? No, we're going to stop doing it and we're going to refocus on this. And that is an unusual discipline in any organization.
Yeah, so this reminds me so much of the OpenAI that I'm in here. It's a change company. Yeah. It's a much bigger company, yeah. But this culture there is there, you know, including some kind of curved ball thrown without warning. So yes. Everything is there. But you at some point disassociated yourself from OpenAI, just voluntarily, of course. Yeah, yeah. And you actually started a company, Inflection, yeah. That was doing AI. Why?
So the thing that was, it was actually more startups with Greylock, whose offices we're sitting in right now, where I was getting an increasing number of requests from partners and companies to get privileged access to OpenAI. And again, to be clear, the board of OpenAI is a 501c3. Mm-hmm. And part of the rules of being a good board member of 501c3 is you do not take from the public coffers to benefit private coffers. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, well, if because I'm on the board and I'm giving privileged access, that's giving a commercial benefit, maybe to my LPs and so forth. And so I was literally going, here's the front door, I can't help you, mm-hmm. was my mm-hmm. conversation as a board member. And I was like, look, there's gonna be a whole bunch of stuff that's doable here commercially. And I think there's a whole bunch of things that can be built as really interesting startups. Greylock should focus entirely on this, which it has. I should focus entirely on this, which I have. And then I was like, okay, should I stay on the board if I'm really doing all this AI investing too? Because my AI investing wasn't like little minor amounts of investment to help build out the OpenAI ecosystem. I wanted the OpenAI ecosystem to be built out. But it was like, no, when you make an investment as a VC, it's how do I make as much economic value for the entity that I'm investing in as possible? Everything else, you know, ethics is as important, society is as important, but like considerations of other companies, competition with other companies, or that's all fine. So I went to Sam with this. I said, look, this is the way I think I'll still be helpful, but I think I should go and help Greylock with this, and I can still help OpenAI as much not being on the board as I can be being on the board, and that way I sidestep this area of conflict. Now, turned out to be I would have been more helpful to be on the board to
possibly
derail. I am nearly certain that wouldn't have happened had I been on the board. Obviously, it's counterfactual and hard to say, mm-hmm. but I have a lot of board experience. Now that I've been doing boards for my very first external board was PayPal. I've been doing boards for over 20 years. I have a lot, like, we don't have clown shows. So it's like, fine. So, and by the way, the new OpenAI board is great. Brett Taylor was the person who I suggested replace me when I was leaving. I'm glad that has ultimately worked out, right?
In a bit more dramatic way than
maybe
intended.
Dramatic, yes, much more dramatic than intended. Now, and then Inflection, part of the theory of this was we saw, and it wasn't only us, Mustafa and I and Karen, that we were going to go into this agentic universe. And that one of the central ways that AI would be used as a human amplifier and as a cognitive industrial revolution and as a co-pilot for a whole set of human capabilities, both work capabilities and life capabilities, was going to be through an agent thing. And so we said, okay, and so what we're going to do is we're going to go create an agent, because we don't know exactly what other people are going to do. Mm-hmm. Are other people going to see the same agent thing we are? Yes, more of them did than didn't. That's totally great. That means we were right.
Yeah.
We just weren't as earlier being right as we as we would have liked. We also were right about some things that was only now recently, like with, for example, ChatGPT 4.0 catching up with, which is train EQ as importantly as you train IQ. That was another of the inflection.
You mean emotional intelligence?
Yes, exactly. You know, have that also be centered, because if you're talking about human amplification, we're not just IQ beings, right? We have lots of other modalities, emotions being a very significant one of them. And so how do we have agents that work with us, that, you know, work for us, that help us with various things? They'll need to be there too. And so in Inflection, we went after that first and most clearly out of all the different AI players. And that was part of what we were doing there. And obviously I'm aware that the press likes a dramatic story, and it's like, well, I left OpenAI because of Inflection. That was actually not the case. I left OpenAI because I needed to be able to represent to a wide range of investments, which included Inflection, that I could be 100% focused on the increase of equity value with no constraints other than humanity, society, ethics, law, right? Which is the normal deal for commercial companies.
Well, that's interesting, because Inflection, if I believe, was a public benefit corporation.
Yes.
So it was not exactly about equity maximization. So why did you do that?
So even when you do a PVC, you still have an equity maximization as a mandate, but you have an explicit set of things that you are advertising to your shareholders, and as the governance of it and the board. It's like, what's the contract by which the board of directors governs who is the CEO, whether or not they approve, you know, plans and massive budgets or risks? Is it with that? Now, without a explicit contract, which is, we are for humanity in the following ways, you have some constraints on your board governance. Like, say I was on the, you know, board of a media company, and what I wanted to do was show many more stories about gender fluidity. And that just happened to be the thing that I wanted to do, because that was the thing that I wanted, for whatever reasons, to make happen. Well, that may not be the right thing as a board of director for a media company that is trying to play a role within its, you know, centrist ecosystem, what its brand promise is, who its customers are, who its employees are, who its shareholders are. And so you have to say, no, you can't push that agenda. Now, if you had that as a public benefit corp, where you said, look, I think that one of the things that we are in the process of learning over the next century is, what does gender really mean for the human condition? And just the fact that gender worked this way 100 years ago doesn't mean this way that gender works this way 100 years from now. An obvious one is, human history is replete with homophobia. And I think that intelligent modern societies get around that. They realize, no, these are just people. People just fine. So wherever that path leads, you go fine. But like, you have to identify that as part of your charter. And so that's what we were doing with Inflection. And as part of the Inflection charter, it was, we will optimize for what does this mean for human beings at scale for improving their health. And like, one of the small ways that this played in is, you could say there's, you know, in a very broad brush, there's two kinds of agents being made. One kind of agent is, oh, don't talk to other people, talk to me, mm-hmm. right? Like, I'm your friend, I'm the person you should be talking to. And that's the non-Inflection kind of agent. Then there's a kind of agent that says, hey, I'm here to help you with your life. And if you said to Inflection's Pi, it's personal intelligence, Pi, obvious, mm-hmm. you know, pun on the brand, hey, you're my best friend. It's like, no, I'm your companion. your other human friends or your friends, hey, have you talked to any of them recently? You know, what? How's that going? To try to, it's theory of the human good is to have you connected in there versus decreased. Even if, by the way, you get more time and engagement, which might lead to more economics by doing the first rather than the second, that's part of what a public benefit corp gives us.
Yes, so this actually leads to two questions I wanted to ask. So let's start with the first one, just about this PBC status. So this is actually kind of not being just the profit maximizing corporation is relatively fashionable in the AI world, like yeah. OpenAI is a non-profit yeah. with this or cap profit structure more precisely. Anthropic is a PBC, Inflection is a PBC.
Yeah.
Do you think this will be like a new trend that will persist, or is it more just like something that just the pioneers in this space chose to do, but might not really last?
I guarantee that it's a trend that's going to last. And what's more, I think it'll be more than just AI companies. And I served on the board of the Mozilla Corporation for 11 years. It's 100% owned by the foundation.
Yeah.
I think that the things that we will see is to say, we can create really good organizations, really good companies that have revenue, that seek profit, that increase equity value, that have additional considerations in how they operate than the pure maximization over the long term of equity value. And I think that what we will learn is, well, what are the type of pattern to say, well, this one is the kind of public benefit corp that will shut down if it doesn't meet its public benefit. This is one that's going to be a profitable company and is going to try to add as much to the public benefit as it can. Like, those are kinds of still terminology and discovery differences in how we evolve. So I have complete conviction we will have more. But by the way, I think it's also useful to have companies that say, look, all we are is about, you know, long-term equity value. You know, what I'm making is spare parts for the following kinds of machines, or, you know, that kind of stuff. And actually, in fact, my driving it as equity value is part of what drives value in the whole ecosystem. It drives value for jobs, it drives value for cost structure, which makes, like, say, for example, it's car parts. Well, then the cost of cars go down, more people can own cars, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so I think that there is a set of things that it isn't that everything should be a public benefit corp. I think it should be a tool that's used selectively, and as we learn it, it'll be used selectively in pattern one, selectively in pattern two, selectively in pattern three, selectively in pattern four, and that's what we're in the process of discovering.
So this was an excellent answer to my first question. My second question was touching on the other thing you mentioned. It's about this, okay, we are creating these agents, these companions, yes, like with GPT-4o, it's kind of movie hair is becoming a reality.
Yes.
And then on one hand, there is many good reasons why this is a good thing. On the other hand, there is this kind of this parasocial relationship that might be maybe not necessarily a positive thing. So in particular, to many, hair is a dystopia, not a utopia for right. sure. So you already mentioned a little bit how you make sure that Pi is not contributing to this, yeah. but like, do you think that's the only worry that we should have over here? Is there something else? Like, why we might not want to live yeah. in the world full of these AI agents?
Well, the central one, and this partially is a kind of an early signal. The first place I will have talked about this in a public forum, quasi-public, a recorded media forum. My next book is entitled Super Agency, and part of the idea is to explore how is the notion that technology, and in particular AI, changes our notion of agency as human beings. And obviously, not surprisingly, given Impromptu and the amplification, you know, human amplification intelligence part of what we're doing, it in some really critical and important ways increases our agency. But it's not just an increase, it's a change. And those alterations of where we fit in agency is, I think, one of the things that has to be an important design characteristic within this. Because what you want to be doing is you want to have an explicit theory about how do we help make human beings better, And for example, sitting on a couch, kind of responding numbly to stimulus, like for example, just, you know, drinking lots of sugary soda and watching mind-numbing stuff is all you're doing, we would think that would be a decrease in human agency, human capability, etc. What we want to be doing is we want to be learning how to be better versions of ourselves, how to be intelligent, wise, compassionate, how to be engaging with other human beings. And it doesn't mean that everyone has to be an extrovert, but, you know, kind of like what is our participation within the human story in terms of how we're playing. And that's roughly where we want to have a theory of the good. So, you know, you could say, well, an obvious one when you get to a personal intelligence companion is to say, well, don't just orient on me. And that's part of the dystopic part of her, which is the you know, to make the Hollywood story drama go, it's the you are my one emotional, you know, connection, etc. And, you know, if you were actually, say, approaching this as a design thing of what you want to be doing, you don't want to have a denouement where suddenly, you know, I don't know if we should do spoilers here, but discovers that, you know, her is having conversations with lots of people, is unhappy at the fact that the dependency has been created and kind of jacks out, right? It's part of it. He's like, well, that's not the right path for getting there. For example, when you're helping a friend of yours who's going through a really difficult time, you might, of course, say, I'm going to come live at your house for a couple of days, right? We're going to talk, we're going to do stuff, et cetera. But part of what your theory of the human good when you're talking to your friend is, okay, how do we get you back on your feet?
Yeah.
Right? How do we get you, you know, kind of doing the things that are evolving you? And that's the complete spectrum of what all AI design aesthetic, I hope, will ultimately head towards. And obviously we'll have a range. And part of our job is technology inventors and creators and business leaders is to make that kind of AI more successful within the realm of business than the one that kind of goes, okay, this keeps you pacified on the couch.
Yeah, so this connects to, I think, in the conclusion of the impromptu book, you talk about, I think, dark gray vision of the future, where exactly like we rely a lot on AI, but in a way that kind of doesn't make us happy. So actually, like, why are you such an optimist that we will avoid this vision? You say, oh, the investors will do it, but like, that's not what we are observing currently in our world. It's like, if there is, yes, you might take the high road, you might think about the human thriving with your product, but others, if it maximizes even the short-term gain, might choose something else, and they will win the market in some way. So where is your optimism coming from here?
I think the thing that's beholden upon us as leaders in society, whether we're technological inventors, entrepreneurs and business creators, CEOs, investors, government people, press people, academics, etc., is to say, how do we make the system of games that we've created, how do we make it so that over time it trends to the very positive for the vast majority of people? And I think it's possible that we can do it with just commercial if we navigate it the right way. But if it's not, then we'll intervene in other ways. It's one of the reasons why, while I'm critical of the AI critics, mostly for how they're doing it, I'm not saying you shouldn't be bringing these issues up. It isn't, no. It's important to have a public discourse. Are we doing the right thing? Are we navigating the concerns and risks the right way? If instead everyone was talking about AI is la, 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 this is all gonna be spectacular, I'd probably be talking about like, whoa, we need to navigate around this issue. There's this important issue to do, right, et cetera. Because it's navigating around these risks to get to what's spectacular that's part of it. The reason I'm so positive on the optimistic side is both because I believe very strongly we can get there. It's not guaranteed. It's one of the reasons why we do these podcasts and a bunch of other things. But I think it's doable. Now, that being said, you know, my critique of the critics is it's very easy to list a set of things about any new technology that's not here, about how it could be dystopic or how it could do something bad. And it's like, for example, the simplest one is if if we had come to the leaders of society and say, we want to create an over 2-ton death machine that drunk human beings can run over other people on, and that people could be really irresponsible and could kill children with, etc. Hey, can we release the car? Right? Then we wouldn't have this society. And like, for example, there's this really good philosopher, Paul Virilio, who says, well, when you invent the ship, you invent the shipwreck. And that's true. But it, in a sense, the aphorism is incomplete, because not only do you invent, when you invent the ship, do you invent the shipwreck, you also invent the shipping civilization. And that's the process that we're in. And so the critics have to be is like, how are we inventing the civilization, and what are the things that we need to steer around? And by the way, in steering around means there will be, like in the car metaphor, there will be car accidents, right? Things will happen. But small accidents to get to a much more beneficial outcome is actually, in fact, a really good thing. The history of medicine is replete with this too. It's like, would you like to have antibiotics? Well, the history of medicine getting there isn't just like one day 100% pure with antibiotics. You have to work your way there.
Okay, so now I understand where your AI optimist stance is. Just saying it's just in the opposition to maybe too much of criticism.
That and a belief we can get there.
And believe we can get there. So speaking of which, so I'm not sure what's now in the cards for Inflection, but you as an investor are involved in advising a lot of startups. So in the current situation, with these current goals, like, what is your usual advice to the startups that want to do something in the AI space?
Well, we don't have enough time, even if we were to do multiple prospects, to really cover all of it.
Well, I would love to. So, you know, it's just up to you.
Yes. Well, maybe we'll do another one too. But to begin, look, generic entrepreneur advice is to have a theory of the game by which, if you succeed at taking some initial risks, you create something that's really valuable for the market, for customers, for society. That theory of the game has to be the, well, which risk are you taking? How can you navigate them? What's the new product and service? Why are you differentiated? How are you going to play out against competition, both small and large? Can you do it within the capital envelope and the time envelope that you have? Do you have a coherent theory of starting small and getting big? There's all these things that are all part of general entrepreneurship wisdom, all of which get mapped in specific ways into AI.
Yes.
Right? So, for example, on the Inflection side, one of the things that we realized was to say that the frontier model agents are going to be rapidly trained at hundreds of millions of dollars well before a business model could make sense to them. And one of the things we had to be doing as a startup was a business model. And she said, okay, Inflection continues by pivoting to having a unique model, one that is GPT-4 class with, EQ and a bunch of other things, and kind of like a dialogue response that's much better than most others, vast majority of others, and make that a set of an AI studio and available to a bunch of entrepreneurs, but not to continue training the model. But then some of the folks, Mustafa, Karen, et cetera, wanted to say, I started this in order to build the human personal intelligence, now Copilot, you know, Microsoft, that would be for you as an individual in everything you're doing. And I want to keep doing that. Right, so that's how that came up. That's an example of advice to a startup in terms of how you're navigating. And there's advice at day one, there's advice at week one, there's advice at month one, and it's as you learn and as you're doing things. Now, generally speaking, part of what you have to do is there's a lot of people going after AI.
Yeah.
Why do you have a unique play here? Unique doesn't have to be 100% unique, but it has to be small n competitors, small end, that you have a good theory about why you will succeed in doing it. Why, like, for example, another way to look at entrepreneurship stuff In an ideal world, most entrepreneurial things, at day one, you look crazy. Mm-hmm. At 2 to 3 years, you look credible. And at 3 to 5 years, you look obvious, right? That's the kind of the play within a venture time window. So when you're looking at all these AI ideas, because some of them don't fit, for example, in that time, it's like, does it fit within this characteristic? Now, maybe it doesn't look quite as, since there's so much interest in AI in the year 0 to 2, it doesn't look as nutty. But it still should be the ones that I'm interested in are the ones that, you know, the ones I think will be most interesting ones are the ones go, oh yeah, most people haven't realized that yet or seen this way this comes together. And this will be, in 3 to 5 years, thought to be obvious. And there's a path to start small and iterate to getting there.
Okay, so one thing that I find very interesting in the way you talk about this is just this kind of role of advice, but also role of the boards. Uh-huh. And again, as you said, you have been on so many boards. Yes. You have a lot of experience. You know, you are, I believe, at the board of Microsoft right now. Yes. You have been before at the board of OpenAI and many other companies. So
Airbnb, PayPal, so a few.
You name it. Just I might have heard about these companies before. Yes. How does it work? Does each board have different styles? So each time you go into the board meeting for a different company, you kind of, you know, you assume a different persona. Like, how do you operate in these boards?
Well, a board is a team, and it does have a set of different fitness functions, where it's got a contract with the shareholders, which includes employees, and the kind of society and an industry that it operates in. And then the question is okay, which team members do what, and how do we most highly perform against that contract? I've actually thought for at least now, I think it was a year into my joining the PayPal board, it was like, oh my God, people don't think about this in enough first principle systematic way. A book needs to be written, one or more book needs to be written about what this game is, how it works. What is qualified? Because, like, for example, one of the things that very few board members have encountered is how do you fire people from the board, which I'm one of the few venture capitalists that I know that has actually fired people from boards, because, and not just like, oh yeah, they were offering drugs to the employees. Yeah, of course you fire them.
Yeah.
No, but like, no, they're perfectly good, competent professionals, and they're not right for this board now. And that comes down to what the theory of, like, what does the board have to be operating? What is it trying to accomplish? Now, let me go to one minor thing, but it still shows you on boards, an emperor has no clothes kind of situation. So the very thoughtful people about boards, Reed Hastings, for example, will tell you the following thing. The primary point of the board is to hire, fire, and compensate the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
You go, great. All right, well, let's go through all the public boards and go, each individual board member, let's evaluate them on what is their competence of hiring, firing, and compensating CEOs? Compensating the ones probably you get a lot of consultants. Hiring, firing CEOs. And the typical answer is, well, we put people who were CEOs on the board, and you're like, well, look, if you had literally nothing else, okay, you were a CEO, so maybe you're a little bit better than the average bear at understanding how to hire and fire CEOs, because you were one, you did the job once.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually not really the full set. The reason why I learned about this by being because I started my board journey by being an independent board member, I'm really then being a VC, you want people who have been on the role multiple times, have a good understanding about like what are the circumstances in which you hire and fire CEOs and how do you look at it for how you do it. And that's one of the things that the vast majority of people on boards actually don't know much about, yet it's one of the most fundamental things.
So your role on the boards is the guy who fires and hires the CEO or other board members? Like, what do you view as your role on this board?
Well, I look around and I say, what should my role on this board be? And then get agreement from the board members, from the CEO, like, here is how I think our roles should be. You know, for example, on the Microsoft board, my primary role, obviously I have a bunch of, we share a bunch of roles, including the hire and firing CEO together.
Yeah.
But like, for example, I'm to work most closely with the Satya and the rest of the executives on technology strategy. The board members say, hey, you know, when they have a question, they'll generally call me first because I spend, you know, a day outside of every board meeting with a bunch of different product groups, kind of saying, okay, what are you working on? And a bunch of it obviously is the AI stuff, but there's also over the years have been other things too.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why, you know, Microsoft redid its browser strategy was because, you know, I went to Satya and I said, you know, this browser strategy doesn't work. Right. And he said, okay, will you meet, like, let's set up a team. Will you meet with the team? I'm like, absolutely, of course. Yeah. And that's part of how this role evolves. But that's the thing. The reason why I'm not dodging giving you crisp answers as much as it's different for different boards, depending on what it is. Now, in the boards that I have been on, where firing the CEO has become a necessary thing, so far, every single time where I'm on the board, and that has become a necessary thing, I'm the person doing it.
Now I'm scared. And I'm even more scared to ask the next question. I'm not even sure if I should, but I will ask anyway. What would be the lesson you would draw from the OpenAI November saga?
Look, it was just from the outside, no inside information. There were a lot of very incompetent things drawn. I will start with a simple one because I just report from my own experience. I was at an event called The Grove in Napa Thursday night. Mira Murati was there at dinner with us.
Oh my God.
Okay. And then she gets up from dinner and heads off. We go, oh, something's happening. And at breakfast, we don't see her. Right. Right. And so I'm driving away, and my chief of staff shows me the blog post, which is, we've fired Sam, and Mira Murati is our interim CEO. Now, just from this, what I knew was they hadn't called her until dinner time the day before. There is no universe in which this is a competent action, right? I mean, it literally would have had to been Sam murdered somebody yesterday and is in jail for murder, right? Okay, you're it. You know, get here right now. Like, that kind of levels up. Like, if it was a, well, like, as far as we can tell from all this stuff is, well, maybe in his communications with certain board members, they had, they felt they weren't getting the full truth, which maybe is the final story. For that, that is so far away from the way that you operate there for trying to be good to the OpenAI mission, beneficial AI for humanity, for the organization. I mean, just like, it's just, that's incompetent. Like, it's literally, it's like, no, like, that is, none of you knew what you were doing, right? And then there was others too. So we could go into a long list of visible from just the facts of the incompetence of the process. Now, I have yet to have a conversation with one of those board members. I'm not averse to it. I probably will sometime later this year. You know, I know everybody on the board well, and I actually think they're good people and so forth about what they were thinking. But what I do know from the outside facts is they won't be able to persuade me that their activity set was competent unless there was some massive Chernobyl-like fact that somehow, even after the board has done an investigation from independent auditors and everything else, somehow has not surfaced, which I don't think it did because we hired Sam, put Sam back on the board, et cetera. Now, that doesn't mean, by the way, the concern of, I have been on boards where I've had startup boards, where I've had CEOs who had to be, had to have their game of how they communicate with a board improved, right? And that can be a conversation that's, call it as emotionally intense as a firing conversation, because it has to be the, you must understand that the thing we're talking about from here on forth has to have zero failure, right? So, because part of the difference in organization, one of the reasons why you give CEOs such power, why you give them such compensation normally, et cetera, as all the rest, is because it's a no excuses rule, right? Like, it's like, you might make mistakes, you may still keep your job because they still, you're the best person from it. But like, sometimes you have conversations where you have zero failure on this. And that is part of what understanding which things, because it's not everything that a CEO has to have zero failure on, which style of communication and what that means as part of a general hiring and firing thing, is one of the things that competent board members bring to the table.
This is actually, honestly, I would love to just do a podcast with you about board dynamics and so on. This was quite interesting, and I definitely would like to, you know, if you ever get to talk to these OpenAI board members, I also know some of them and actually respect them quite a lot, to just what was the conclusion. But moving back to something you mentioned in passing a bit earlier, is kind of this thinking about, like, you acknowledge, okay, you are the AI optimist, but it's more because you think that's what the optimism is, what we need right now in the context of AI conversations. Well, you are mentioning this, oh, you know, there will be some small failures before we figure it out. But then there are many people who are worried that the small failures may not be so small, right? So maybe that's kind of why there's a lot of sensitivity here. So still, Reid, putting your AI safety hat on, like, what are your top concerns in this space? Like, what would you, even to think about AI safety, what are you worried the most about?
So, generally speaking, a lot of the, you know, call it thinkers, inventors, leaders in the space, many of them go to what I call a science fiction risk. It's the Terminator risk. It's the, it becomes super intelligence. It's the robocalypse. It's the, you know, da, 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 da. And it isn't, like, part of the thing that's challenging is there isn't a 0% chance of that. But by the way, there's a lot of things that there's not a 0% chance of. Not a 0% chance of we have nuclear war, you know, this year. It's not a 0% chance that we have man-made or natural pandemic that collapses civilization this year.
This year worries me, but okay, please continue.
No, but it's possible.
Of course.
Right? I'm just saying, look, I think it's very unlikely. And by the way, part of the reason why I'm such an AI optimist, when I get to, like there was this statement last year, which a bunch of OpenAI people signed, Mustafa signed, a bunch of Microsoft people signed. It was this 22-word statement about, like, AI should be treated as a existential risk along with, you know, climate change, pandemic, et cetera. And I was like, well, actually, I can't sign this. And the reason I couldn't sign it is that it's not the same, because AI also has a positive column. And the best way that I can think of to prevent pandemic, man-made or natural, and to have that existential risk greatly mitigated is AI. So it's not the same, because it has positive column too, right? And that's the reason why that kind of, like, no, how do we steer towards that? And the science fiction people are going, wait, the robots might be coming. It's like, well, look, it's above 0%. But by the way, the humans, bioterrorists are coming too. What are we going to do about them?
Well, some people worry about AI impact on that as well.
So. Well, yes, but this gets to, because this is the precisely the answer that I'm going towards, is my primary worry that I tell everyone I talk to, press people, government people, AI researchers, entrepreneurs, is we need to focus first on AI in the hands of human beings who have bad intents. It could be crazy individuals, it could be terrorist groups, it could be rogue states, it could be criminals. Look at that first, mitigate that first. Like, the other things are good to space. Look, I can play up science fiction stories with the best of them and talk about, like, okay, what are the things that we do if suddenly this thing is so far cognitively superior to us that it is to us like we are to a worm, okay, that's a baffling universe. It's an interesting conversation to be. It's not clear at all that we are on path to that. We might be, but it's certainly not a likelihood, right? Like, it's not, you can't say it's 30% today, I don't think. You might get to some point, you go, ooh, it's 30%. If you look at all the things, there are superpowers. GPT-4 has a superpower. It is better than human beings. There's no human being on the planet that is better than it at some of the things that it can do. We will increase those superpowers in a way that there will be you know, more and more things that these things can do that are better than any human being on the planet. That's not the same thing as the super genius to us as the worm. Right? That's just not the same thing. That's the reason why it's like, well, but it's getting better. It's like, yeah, it's getting better, but it's not necessarily getting better on that vector. It's the mistake that people make on exponential curves. They go, oh, look, exponential curve, and then here it reaches singularity and everything changes. And you're like, look, that's not the way exponential curves, like, what curve is being exponentiated? And how long does it stay in a J curve before it gets to an S curve? Every J curve gets to an S curve. Now, where it is, that's a very relevant question. Anyway, so this is a little bit belabored, but the really central risk that I tell everyone to say, I really only want you to start talking about the other risks once you have thought through in detail for now and evolving, because we don't know everything now, what is AI in the hands of human beings with bad intent in these different categories look like, and what should we be doing to navigate that? After we have that conversation, great. I'm good for the variety of other conversations.
So this is a good place for me to plug the team that I'm heading at OpenAI, which exactly tries to answer this question. It's just like, if we think AI is a technology and potential for misuse, how bad can it be, and how can we monitor and mitigate that?
And all the great companies have groups like yours.
That's great. So yes. Hopefully this will, you know, yes. I will contribute in some ways, yes, to the greatness of OpenAI here. This letter, this 22-word letter, was one that you did not sign.
Yes.
There was another letter in the space last year. There was the pause AI development letter, the 6 months pause letter, which you not only did not sign, you actually criticized. Is it just exactly for the reasons that you mentioned? Like, what you actually, if I remember correctly, you went against this letter quite vocally. So.
Oh, yes, I did. Look, because I believe intensely, as probably people listening still,
yes,
in the value of discourse, truth-telling. Mm-hmm. Like, so I want people to challenge me. I want to get to how do we find truth together? So I sat down with some of the authors of the six-month pause letter, and I said, what was your theory of the game? Like, you wrote this letter, and what did you think was going to happen? And they said, well, we were hoping people were going to pause. And I'm like, okay. So I thought I was going to have to talk to you about why pausing was kind of foolish, why continuing, like, how do you continue down the journey and navigate the risks is an important thing. But actually, we first have to talk about how you misunderstand human beings. Right? Because you failed on human beings in two very significant ways. One, the primary authors of the letter knew all of the heads of the frontier AI groups. They knew all of the people there. As opposed to calling them and talking to them and saying, hey, look, we have this concern, and could we get you involved? We may still announce anyway, but get you involved. They went and grandstanded on doing the six-month pause letter, surprising all the people with it. What they were saying to these organizations was kind of the equivalent of, piss off, we're the real humanists. We care, you don't care, and we're trying to embarrass you in public. Now, if someone treats you that way as a human being, what's your normal reaction to them? Well, it's like, me piss off, you piss off. Like, I'm not gonna talk, I'm not gonna take you seriously anymore. It's like, look, you just burned your credibility with these people who, like OpenAI, have people like you and groups that are like concerned about this stuff, and you just grandstanded about like them being bad people, right, in the way that you did it. Terrible theory of the game, terrible theory of organizational influence. Like I think all of the people who architect that letter have less influence now on people listening to them about their concerns. The second was more of a game theory thing. So this goes to a little bit more of your MIT prof and other kinds of things, which is simple 2x2 matrix. People are gonna listen to your letter, people are not gonna listen to your letter, right? So, and then slow down, not slow down. Well, so what do you think the characteristic of the people who listen to your letter and slow down are? Those are the people who care about humanity. In the people who don't slow down, listening to your letter or otherwise, those now are going to be going and creating AI, not caring about the concerns around what makes humanity. So if you were successful in your letter and getting the people who would listen to you to pause, you were causing more damage to humanity, to your explicit goal, than you were creating goodness. It's like a unforced, terrible error.
I believe, again, not that I will be defending this letter. Yes. Anyway, I think the hope was that everyone pauses in a coordinated manner, but you are right that this is...
What's your theory of humanity? Like, look, if your theory of humanity is the UN is a high-functioning organization that addresses every global crisis in really good ways,
of course,
evolve your theory of humanity.
I am, you know, I always want to see the best. Yes. Well, I am Polish, so really, that's not my theory. But I could, I hope we will better than we are, maybe as a humanity. Hopefully, we will be. So this actually brings me to another kind of question I wanted to explore with you, saying, because there's this competition, and in particular, if you think about AI, it's something that is important from the point of view of humanity as a kind of collection of people, society, economy, but it's also a geopolitical question. So different countries want to be kind of leading in AI, and naturally there is some kind of competition. So what is your view of the game here? Like, what is the state here?
Well, so not surprisingly, it once again aligns with, I think what we should have is a theory, a sophisticated and improving theory about what humanity and human good is. And I want the societies and the industries that have a good theory of that human good to be the ones leading the way. And, you know, quite typically my ethics tends to be a version of transatlantic. There's things from Europe that I think Europe gets better than the US. There's things in the US I think is better than Europe. But by the way, it's not just Europe and US. I learn things from every major culture. It's one of the things I loved about visiting the Chinese. There's actually things there for us to learn and to still all get to a better.
An example?
This is gonna be maybe a little too vague. But where should we be balancing competition and cooperation? Within the kind of, especially American tradition, but also, you know, European as well, there is a kind of, I'd say it slants a little bit too much towards competition. That there are things we should say, no, actually, in fact, we're going to make sure that in this, there is more collaboration and incentives for collaboration. And for example, like a simple one is one of the things that the top frontier labs have difficulty navigating is they're coordinating with each other on safety topics because the antitrust rule of law is if you're coordinating at all, it must be for very bad purposes. It must be for like capturing the market and pricing and
well, they're often not wrong.
No, look, there are cases where that's the case.
Yeah. I'm not saying that this happened here.
What I would say is we need to have channels by which we could say, okay, how do we get these kinds of cooperation to be enabled without, you know, allowing this kind of, you know, dividing of a market? Fine. Let's figure out how to do that. That's a doable thing. The part of the way that I've hacked that is I have, you know, universities and nonprofits host the thing with lawyers in the room to make sure that the lawyers can say there was never a discussion of market competition pricing. Right, it was all about like what harms could be done with this, what are your test harm, what are you doing to try to obviate those harms, which harms might we not be anticipating that we should pre-anticipate, and how do we do that, you know, et cetera, which we need and should have and should be collectively in this. So I think the Chinese, like you can almost tell it, like their negotiation posture is funny. So in the US and in Europe, it's you sit across the table because it's oppositional. When you're meeting with, when you're doing meetings, especially with government in China, you sit parallel alongside. It's not against, like it's symbolic. It's not, you're still talking to each other, but you're not, we're trying to physically design this to say we're collaborating on it. Now, a little bit of that's theater, right? But
it matters.
But it matters. And the question is, like, for example, I think one of the reasons that some of the things that I've learned from China are, what are the places where mandates about working collaboratively are good to establish? Now, there's bad ones too, right? We say, well, we're going to demolish this village, you know, without very much consideration to people, or we're going to, you know, treat racial minorities really terribly, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I myself am a believer that it's important to have democracy. There's not a unique statement in this country or Europe, but I think that it's important to have your government be accountable to the ballot box, right? That's another thing where I think they could actually learn that from other places. They disagree, but I think it's a good thing. One of the things I thought was really smart that Frank Fukuyama said at a conference that I was in China, is he said, look, even if you keep your Mandarinate system with the Communist Party of China, and you don't have democracy, you should still establish a constitution, right? And I thought that was that is, I think, a no-brainer for them to do. It's like, here's the human rights and the process that we find sacred, and we ourselves within the government will be bound by it. It's one of the amazing things that the history of governance and having things like constitutions and democracies to work with them, Magna Carta, a bunch of other things, is actually one of the things that I think is a great thing that I would want to be more in a system. So that wraps all the way back to your question of, I am trying within my, you know, two little hands and, you know, my bike that I pedal around, to have the people who are building what I think is for the good theory of, for the elevation of the human condition, for increasing our agency, increasing our capabilities, increasing our knowledge of each other and the world, to making a more peaceful and compassionate society. I'm trying to make the AI help those forces and be designed in line with those forces, and then decrement the ones that are trying to say, no, we should be living in autocracies.
So first of all, I think I will need to rethink the setup for the podcast, because now we should kind of talk in parallel to each other as opposed to across. That's one lesson here. But okay, so that's where you want things to go. But like, how, in your opinion, things are currently evolving? Like, what is this geopolitical game around AI shaping up right now?
There's a whole bunch of technology and technological development and startup and entrepreneurial stuff I've learned from China. Part of my book, Blitzscaling, was not just from Silicon Valley, but learning from China too. Mm-hmm. So I look at China as coopetition, right? There's things that I think we need to be connecting with them and cooperating on, but there's things we're competing on, right? Because which technological norms should be the norms that, you know, kind of are technology across the world? So for example, you know, China has no problem being a surveillance society, you know, dealing with its kind of police state with a number of different companies that enable doing that. We handle that differently. And that's an area where AI will play. So I want US-European AI to be much more competitively successful than these kinds of AI projects in order to set, you know, kind of world norm. So I help European governments, Commonwealth governments, the US, on kind of how should we be embracing the cognitive industrial revolution, investing in companies in each of these places. Not at all, but, you know, like, I'm willing to across them, and I have done a number. I give advice to anybody who I think's ethics aligns with my own, wherever they are in the world, to try to help those ethics, you know, spread and direct what kinds of things are going. So for example, you know, I look at Russia as demonstrated by its activities, both in the Ukraine and the Middle East, as uncaring about violence and suffering to many other groups of people, in balance to its own interests. And so I'm opposed to Russia's success in AI until their governance system changes, right, and is credible and believable. So I basically go and work with organizations that I think follow this ethic wherever they are globally, not just the US. I was part of helping the UK AI Safety Institute. I think they're doing a fantastic job, right? And I've done similar things in other European countries. And I don't help place either companies or countries that I think don't have what is the current modern theory of, and it will always be evolving and dynamic, of what is the elevation of humanity.
Okay, I still did not get answer to my question. So I will ask.
Try once more.
Point blank. We have like this three different.
Oh, where's the race look like?
Yes.
Okay, yes, got it. So I remember that from the question. I just wanted to answer the other one first. I think that Silicon Valley and London and London is obviously through DeepMind and Google, but there's a number of interesting startups that are happening there too, Microsoft with Seattle. So it's West Coast, maybe not just Silicon Valley, although obviously a lot of Microsoft is with OpenAI, which, you know, has a, you know, kind of partnership characteristic across it. And so I think those are ahead. I'd say if you were to bet, you would say it's about 2 years right now. But it's a very fast moving thing against very fierce competitors. The French, to their credit, I think are coming up the curve very well. I think in part that's because they have in-depth technical and the various labs have had a lot of French technical people, and those people are doing startups now within Paris. And I think that they have the speed at which they're approaching GPT-4 class models, I think, has been impressive. So I think that's very good. By the way, I actually think one of the under-countered places as possibility is Poland. I think there's a lot of AI talent there.
I've noticed, but many of them are in the company yes. with me. So, yes.
Yes. Well, but by the way, that's not necessarily ultimately bad. Like the Paris AI efforts wouldn't have worked if it wasn't people coming out of DeepMind, Meta, et cetera, who had had the exposure with these American companies about how the play works. And then here's how we do it here in France.
Okay, so essentially, if I and my friends want to come back to Poland to do startup, you will fund us.
Yes.
Great. That's one more thing I learned and got from this podcast.
Yes.
But anyway, yeah, so you're speaking about France. Like who else? Where is China in this?
So China is, as a technological inventive country and as an entrepreneurial country, is the place that Silicon Valley... You meet a lot of very smart people here who think it's inevitable China's going to win, because China has a lot of natural advantages. They have a natural advantage in the depth of technical talent that they have. They had an advantage in they don't have as many antibodies trying to get in the way of succeeding in technological innovation. Some of those antibodies with us are good. Some of them are not good. Like, one of the things that we would be better at is sorting between the good and the not good, right? Keep the good, of course. But like, for example, like if you said, is stuff around medical data and AI more likely to emerge out of China than out of the US? Yes, because of the fact that they will say, look, we'll take some risks here on the medical data, which our legal system won't allow us to do. So China has advantages all there, right? Mm-hmm. They have a manufacturing advantage, the, you know, CHIPS Act, and other things are good initial efforts on, but a bunch of stuff that we need to pay attention to. So I think saying we're 2 years ahead is not a statement of, oh yeah, we're fine. It's a statement of, we're only 2 years ahead.
Okay, that's an interesting statement. So very briefly, like, what should we do to kind of make sure that, like, if you really are, we are really rooting for this transatlantic kind of democracies, then, like, what is the play here to make sure that, you know, the AI is kind of where it should be there?
So I think the key question is, Like, everyone wants to talk about the risks. They're not building it themselves. And what their contribution is building the risks. The problem is if the small number of people who are building it are only being engaged with people who are like, oh, risk, you have a problem. So you need to change the paradigm for our risk conversation is only these risks to focus on now. And then a dialogue about which risk we add. And how much we get that through voluntary commitments, how much we get that through executive orders, how much we get that through regulatory agencies and actions, I think is something we work out over time. But we work it out carefully because we don't want to kill the future that could be a doctor on every smartphone, a tutor on every smartphone for people of any age, anywhere in the world. Massive elevation in humanity. So I think what we should be doing, like, for example, this presages the medical stuff. If I could wave a wand on medical regulation as a positive of us going forward, I would say, look, if you train your AI to identify itself not as a doctor, to ask if it has, if the person has access to a doctor, right, and then to coordinate with the doctor if there is a doctor in some way, then if you do all that first, then you can also say, look, I'm not a doctor, but here's some things you might want to consider in the medical thing you're considering, and that's okay. You have safe harbor from that, right? Because then, as opposed to, oh, wait, you're saying you're a doctor, you're getting medical advice, you know, because then all of the people, billions and billions of people around the world who do not have access to a doctor, can suddenly have an AI that's trained for them that they can go, oh, my kid's got dysentery and I don't know what to do. And the AI could say, well, try some different water, right? You know, like these kind of things. We want those AI, those AIs are buildable today. We want them. That's a crisp example of how do, as opposed to talking risk, how do we enable the creation of things that will be amazing for humanity? And that's where the dialogue should be.
Okay, so this actually brings to the other question I wanted to ask in this context. It's exactly Global South. So yeah, we talk about US, Europe, China, but that's not all of the world. There are some other countries in Global South and also in other countries in general. So how do we make sure they also win on this AI revolution? So how, what should we do to ensure that?
I'd say the, because look, you're not gonna be able to give them everything that you're gonna get as an advantage from the fact that you're investing billions and billions and billions of dollars across various companies and private money and all the rest, that's gonna cause a bunch of very good progress, and you're not gonna just give it all away.
Well, OpenAI might do some of that. That's part of the mission.
Yeah, but you also, look, there's gonna be a lot of, OpenAI is not gonna be the only AI project in the world.
Of course.
Right, there's gonna be a lot of AI goods that that are commercially provisioned. And by the way, one of the more interesting things is OpenAI couldn't be where it is without its commercial partnership with Microsoft, right? So, and that's good for the OpenAI mission.
Yes.
Right, so it's kind of a complicated thing. And so I think the central thing is to think about which are the things that we can most include the entire rest of the world, the Global South, in, both in the benefits in like kind of three areas. One, the benefits of what's coming, right? So if you make a medical assistant, don't just provision it to, you know, people who might be able to pay you, you know, much more money than people in the Global South. Figure out how to do a version that also helps the Global South, even though the Global South may be poorer than a first world market. Two, engage in conversation, right? Be part of the dialogue with them, not say, hey, we're gonna build it, you're gonna like it. Like, what are your concerns? What are your things? By the way, one of the things that a lot of Western academics and other things don't realize is their top concern is, don't leave me out. It's not, I need you to build it in Spanish or, you know, French or whatever. It's the, don't leave me out, right? Like, make it available to me. And then the third is, as much as we can, enable startups and entrepreneurs in these areas too, because there's a bunch of technological talent. There's a bunch of talent that can help make all of this much better in as products, as services, as technologies. And let's make sure that that's, the loop is inclusive in that.
Okay, this is a great point to stop. So just our final question. So as we are seeing this progress on AI and we see about this like AI-ushered future, what is the aspect of that future that you are personally looking the most or the least to?
Well, part of the reason why I started Inflection and Pi is I do think that it's a certain part of the future that every human being who has access to kind of the equivalent of a smartphone will have a personal intelligence that is theirs.
Pi,
right? Whether it's a Copilot, whether it's ChatGPT, anything, they will have something that's there. And I think that will be amazing. I think that the thing that I want to steer away from is, look, it's a very natural thing for humans to be lazy. I myself am lazy about a number of things. And it's good to be lazy about some stuff. That's how we learn progress. But we also want to learn what not to be lazy about. And part of it is our becoming more capable in a variety of things that matters as human beings. And intelligence is obviously one thing that matters, but so does compassion, so does wisdom, so does emotional intelligence, so does, you know, and to not be lazy about that and to not give up agency about that, which is, of course, the reason why I'm working on a book on agency.
Thank you, Reid. This was a thrilling conversation.
Thank you.
Today, we had a pleasure to talk with Reid Hoffman, someone who engaged with AI from just about every angle. If you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, please subscribe, share with your friends, and leave a comment. Thanks.